Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Daily Podcast. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up today. It's Friday, so we have a new column, freshly added to the archives. You probably know this, but the newspapers get a two-month exclusive on each Offbeat Oregon History column. The end of that 2 months, they go into the archives, and I post them at OffbeatOregon.com and record a podcast from them. And for this story, those 2 months have just gone by. So here it is. I hope you enjoy it. This is the story about the first prohibition law in American history and the fine distilled beverage that drove lawmakers to take that step. Before Oregon was even a state, its territorial government outlawed all booze. Why? Well, if you could go back to 1844, you could ask the true founder of the city of Portland, and he would show you his ever-bubbling moonshine still. The story was first published on November 24th of 2013. Here we go. Most people know prohibition in the United States started in 1920 when the Volstead Act went into effect. But in Oregon, prohibition started a little earlier than that. Actually, it started quite a bit earlier, before Oregon was even a state. In 1844, the Oregon Territorial Government became the first in the United States to outlaw the sale, use, or manufacture of booze. The full story of Oregon Territory's first experiment with prohibition will probably never be known fully. Not a lot of written history has come down to us from the early 1840s in Oregon, and what we have is often contradictory. But from a distance, it looks an awful lot like the whole thing was inspired, if that's the right word, by the commercial activities of one man, a fellow named William Johnson. And that one man's product, a rough and ready distilled beverage marketed under a picturesque and, most sources agree, accurate name, Blue Ruin. The introduction of Johnson's Blue Ruin to the Willamette Valley frontier community was followed almost immediately by America's first prohibition law, the preamble to which gives a few hints as to why lawmakers felt that this was necessary. I'm going to read extensively from it now. Quote, "Whereas the people of Oregon now occupy one of the most beautiful and interesting portions of the globe and are placed in the most critical and responsible position ever filled by men, having as they do important duties to themselves, to their century, to posterity, and to mankind, as the founders of a new government and a young nation. And whereas the introduction, distillation, or sale of ardent spirits under the circumstances in which we are placed would bring withering ruin upon the prosperity and prospects of this interesting and rising community, by involving us in idle and dissolute habits, inviting hither swarms of the dissipated inhabitants of other countries, cluttering emigration, destroying the industry of the country, bringing upon us the swarms of savages now in our midst, interrupting the orderly and peaceable administration of justice, and in a word," hang on, this is going to be a long word, "producing and perpetrating increasing untoward miseries that no mind can rightly estimate." Long word, I warned you. "Therefore, be it enacted by the Legislative Committee of Oregon as follows." And it continues in this vein for some length, actually. Okay, fair enough. And yet the members of the Legislative Committee of Oregon were frontier men. They liked a little nip now and then. Why would they pass a law that most of them would subsequently be violating on a regular basis? The true answer lies coyly camouflaged among the references to industry and prosperity. It's the part about "bringing upon us the swarms of savages now in our midst," which gets us right back to Mr. Johnson. Mr. William Johnson, it seems, had settled in a little clearing by the river a dozen or so miles downstream from Willamette Falls in around 1842. Different sources give different accounts of Johnson. One says he was a deserter from a British man of war who'd settled there, hiding out from the Brits. Others say he was a 50-year-old family man living in Shampooey in the late 1830s with a successful farm, who for some reason abandoned his land claim and moved 50 miles down the river to stake out a new one. The explanation may be that there were two William Johnsons in the valley at the time, Farmer Johnson and Bootlegger Johnson. Or perhaps he did something to get tossed out of the Shampooey community. We just don't know. But in any case, Bootlegger Johnson very quickly figured out that an ambitious distiller could sell every drop of liquor that he squeezed out of whatever horrific precursor sugars could be had. Table scraps, molasses, rotten tomatoes, floor sweepings from the nearest flour mill, whatever. The bluish-clear substance that oozed out of his still was like a raw, searing mixture of unaged grappa, white whiskey, and Everclear. It's also a good bet that, being keen to save resources, Johnson didn't bother to discard the heads, which is the ounce or two of whiskey that always comes out of the still with each batch, which contains all the toxic hangover-inducing wood alcohols and other nasty chemicals. But it was cheap. There was plenty of it, and it was good enough for Johnson's primary customers, the Native Americans. Many of the leaders of Oregon's provisional government were former Hudson's Bay Company employees. They knew from first-hand experience that letting Native Americans buy as much whiskey as they wanted was a recipe for trouble. The Pacific Northwest natives had virtually no ability to resist liquor. They would drink as much of it as they could get, as fast as they could. It would transform them from peaceful, happy people into raging, brawling rioters. The best-case scenario was a sharp drop in their production of otter pelts, and the worst-case scenario was bloodshed and property destruction. So the old Hudson's Bay men were careful to prevent whiskey from falling into Native American hands. Yet those Native American hands were unusually eager to get the stuff. The laws of supply and demand being what they are, the arrival of Johnson or somebody like him was probably inevitable. Once Johnson's commercial enterprises came to the attention of U.S. Indian agent Elijah White, the official journeyed to Johnson's place and destroyed his still. And it was around that same time that the provisional government convened and outlawed his trade. Johnson's reaction to this seems to have been to find a better hiding place for his rebuilt still. He may also have raised his prices. He certainly didn't quit making deliveries. Any questions about whether Blue Ruin was a genuine public menace are answered rather nicely in the memoirs of one of Johnson's erstwhile partners, a rough-and-ready French-Canadian gambler and all-around rascal named Edward Chambreau. Here's how Chambreau remembers his first liquor run with Johnson. Quote, "The next morning the skiff was made ready with a 20-gallon keg of Blue Ruin. This was hid under the things in the bottom of the boat. There were quite a number of Indians camped here, and they were anxious to swap for lum, the word for whiskey. We made them sit down in rows with their different things they had to put their lum in and whatever they had to pay for it. They were all on the beach about 10 steps from the skiff. We went to every one before we began to pour it out in their vessels and agreed on what should be given for this and that measureful. Having done this, Johnson began to pour out, and I carried the things to the boat. The principal things we got in exchange was beaver and otter skins and Hudson's Bay blankets. An Indian, when he drinks whiskey, he will drink as long as he can hold his breath. By the time Johnson was getting through with the last ones, the first ones were getting very funny. He shouted for me to run for the boat. I ran to the boat and shoved it until I was knee-deep in the water. As he had the whiskey, some of them followed him to the boat. He was retreating backwards with his keg under his arm and his big long knife in the other. In the meantime, I covered him with my rifle. Before it takes time to tell it, he threw the keg with what remained in it as far as he could toward the camp. This gave him a chance to get away from those who were immediately near him, and he got into the boat. We were almost in swimming water, with 3 Indians hanging yet to the boat. We knocked them over the head and shoved off just in the nick of time, because we had no more than had them loose from the boat than there was a gang of about 30 came running and yelling with all their might. Then the fighting was among themselves. On this trip we made very near $500 apiece," Chambreau concludes. The reader can draw his own conclusions of what must have been the scene in that Indian camp with 20 gallons of that abominable stuff in them. William Johnson died the following year. I haven't been able to find a source that will give a cause of death, but a couple of them hint that it happened during one of these deliveries, a fate that seems grimly appropriate. Poetic justice. In any case, Oregon's prohibition law was repealed the year after Johnson died, and after that, the booze flowed pretty freely, right up until the 1910s. The still Johnson was running when Chambreau helped him make that 1847 delivery was tucked away in a gully about 4 miles downstream from Oregon City. a setting much more in keeping with the spirit of an illicit moonshine still. But it's worth noting the location of the first one he set up, the one White destroyed when he learned the Native Americans were being supplied by it. Most likely it was conveniently located by his cabin, in the middle of what's now Macadam Avenue near the Ross Island Bridge, right in the middle of Portland. Johnson's was the first house in Portland, and it seems the first business. Well, that's our show for today. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone newsreader, a series of live history shows, a Facebook page, and a couple of other minor components, YouTube channel, Tumblr blog, stuff like that, all accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Visual goodies and other resources that go with today's show can be found at offbeatoregon.com, where you'll also find full citations to the sources for this story, as well as more than 250 other Offbeat Oregon History columns written over the past 5 years. Like this podcast, those articles are covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon History for fun and to learn stuff, so I don't sell advertising or ask for donations, but if you enjoy Offbeat Oregon History and would like to support it, you can always buy a copy of my book. If you enjoy this podcast, I can almost guarantee that you will like the book. It's called Wicked Portland. It's published by the History Press in 2012, and they're available at community bookstores. Or if you like, you can order a signed copy through the store link at offbeatoregon.com or catch me at one of the shows. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in the neighborhood near Oregon State University, do drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee in the library coffee shop and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Our next show will be coming your way around 6 a.m. Monday morning. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of today and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.